find all the case information you need faster. Smart litigators rely on Bloomberg Law's broad litigation news coverage and our market-leading dockets. Now with AI-driven search and analytics, customized alerts, and expansive state court coverage. Visit pro.bloomberglaw.com for everything you need to win.
Welcome to Cases and Controversies, a Supreme Court podcast by Bloomberg Law. I'm Lydia Wheeler.
And I'm Kimberly Robinson. The justices kicked off their final sitting of the term this week with a couple of big cases, one in a public corruption case, another an appeal from a January 6th defendant who says that prosecutors went too far in charging him with an Enron-era statute that could affect many other prosecutions, as well as the one against former President Donald Trump, as we heard last week.
Right. Since you did a deep dive on that case while I was off, I thought that we could preview the court's second abortion-related case that's going to be argued next Wednesday. That's a fight over Idaho's near total ban on abortion and if it applies even in emergency situations when the procedure is needed to prevent the serious risk to the mother. Joining us to discuss the case is John Bursch, Senior Counsel and Vice President of Appellate Advocacy at Alliance Defending Freedom, a Christian nonprofit legal firm that's helping Idaho's Attorney General defend its anti-abortion law. Well, John, thanks so much for joining us. Can you start off by explaining how this case came about?
Sure. Idaho, exercising its democratic powers, passed what's called the Defense of Life Act in 2020, and it protects all life, including unborn life, beginning at conception, except for the life of the mother or rape or incest. There's a federal law. It's called EMTALA, E-M-T-A-L-A, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act. And it was passed by a bipartisan vote in Congress, signed into law by President Reagan in the 1980s. And it was intended to overrule a common law standard in every state that did not require emergency medical treatment. There was no requirement to treat. So what that meant is if a patient who didn't have any money or insurance showed up at a hospital and they were in critical need of medical condition, EMTALA required the hospital to stabilize them so that they wouldn't just suffer there on the sidewalk or be sent away in a car. And so that's how the law functioned for nearly 40 years. That's how the administration interpreted it. That's how courts looked at it. And everybody understood that it was built on a foundation of the state regulation of the practice of medicine. So when it came to the medical care standard or it came to what was prohibited or allowed, you always deferred to state law. That all changed once the U.S. Supreme Court decided Dobbs in 2022. In the immediate aftermath of that decision, President Biden disagreed with it, but recognized that every state would now decide for themselves whether abortion would be allowed in that state. And then 2 weeks later, he changed his mind and he directed that CMS would reinterpret EMTALA to require abortion in hospital emergency rooms. And the administration issued guidance on that, but then they went farther. They actually sued Idaho in a test case and obtained an injunction against Idaho's Defense of Life Act as applied to hospital emergency rooms. And that injunction was granted by a district court. A Ninth Circuit panel reversed it and said EMTALA doesn't require any specific treatment. It defers to state law as to whether doctors can or cannot do something. The Ninth Circuit en banc set aside the panel decision in an unreasoned order. And then the U.S. Supreme Court granted an application for an injunction on appeal and also decided to grant the case and hear it on the merits because it obviously has nationwide implications. And so that's what brings us to the argument that's coming up.
Well, I feel like that's a lot of whiplash as far as whether or not the law is on, it's off, it's on, it's off, it's on and on and again. But I wonder, and this isn't totally fair for us to ask you, but if you could sort of give our listeners a little bit of a sense of why the Biden administration says that EMTALA preempts at least part of the Idaho law here.
Well, when President Biden made his directive to federal agencies to expand abortion rights at the federal level, including EMTALA, he very clearly articulated that it was a response to Dobbs, that he wanted to ensure the maximum access to abortion possible as a result of that decision, notwithstanding his initial comments, which were that this would be left up to every state. And what was so extraordinary about the reinterpretation of EMTALA is that the reinterpretation isn't limited to abortion. In this particular instance, the administration is using it to try to override Idahoans' choice to preserve life. EMTALA, too, is supposed to preserve life, both the pregnant mom, but also the unborn child, as we can get into later. But this applies across the board to any medical procedure or medication that might be prohibited at the state level. So for example, in New Jersey, if you go to the emergency room and you're in some kind of extreme pain and you need to have that relieved, but you don't have any money, and so they treat you under Emtala, they can give you an opioid that prescription can only last up to 5 days because of their concern that you might get addicted to the opioid. Well, under the Biden administration's interpretation, if the emergency room doctor thinks that a 30-day opioid prescription is necessary to stabilize the person in their pain, then the doctor can make that prescription and violate state law. And that doesn't really make sense because Emtala is part of the Medicare Act. And the very first provision of the Medicare Act states that the federal government will not be directing states in how medical services are provided. So this goes against a 40-year understanding of the statute, its very first provision, and has ramifications that expand far beyond the abortion context.
I wanted to ask sort of a follow-up question. You were talking about how this law has sort of been interpreted a particular way for 40 years. The Biden administration's response to that is that, you know, everything changed when we had Dobbs and overturning Roe. And just sort of wondering, you know, if you think that that's necessary, if you think that's a valid argument for why, you know, courts wouldn't have had an opportunity to really address how EMTALA applies to abortion law in the past.
Yeah, that's wrong for two reasons. First, it's a misstatement of the history of what actually happened, because even when Roe and Casey were still on the books, states had laws that prohibited abortions that were late term after the baby was already viable. They had laws that required parental consent. They had laws that required a waiting period or an ultrasound and things like that. And the federal government never once, at least in any instance they've ever pointed to, cited a hospital for failing to provide an abortion that violated one of those provisions. It just never happened. In fact, in their brief, the government cites to these Excel spreadsheets that have over 115,000 examples where federal law under Medicare was enforced against a hospital in some way. I think 7,000 of those might relate to EMTALA. And there's not a single one that requires a hospital to act in contravention of a state abortion law, not one. So as a matter of historical fact, that's just not accurate. As a matter of law, that's not also not accurate because CMS, which is a subdivision of HHS, it's the agency that's responsible for enforcing the Medicare Act, all of it, not just EMTALA, the whole thing. All of their guidance documents, including the EMTALA manual that the government cites in its brief to the Supreme Court, says that state laws regarding medical practice control. That anytime the federal government looks to see whether a hospital acted appropriately under EMTALA in any given situation, state and local standards of practice will be the guideline for that. You can't fault them for failing to, say, if you're in Idaho, for failing to follow the New Jersey standard of care. And there is no U.S. standard of care. We know that when Medicare or Medicaid direct certain medications and, you know, how they can be prescribed in order to get reimbursed and all that, there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of pages in the Federal Register that control that. But when it comes to regular practice in the emergency room, you won't find one page anywhere in the Federal Register or in the CFRs that dictate how doctors are supposed to respond. It's all controlled by state and local law.
So here the federal government is basically arguing that Idaho can't stop emergency room doctors from performing these abortions in emergency situations. But I'm wondering, you know, they're saying basically EMTALA trumps state law. But what did the lower courts say?
Well, the district court agreed with that. The Court of Appeals panel, the motions panel, which was the only appellate panel in this case to write an opinion. Again, the en banc order that overruled it was unreasoned. It was just a one-sentence order. That panel said EMTALA does not prescribe what treatment to provide and never has. That what EMTALA does is it tells you you must treat an indigent patient or any patient who presents at the emergency room, but it doesn't say how to treat them. In fact, the Fifth Circuit, examining the same statute in an identical context, said that EMTALA only has one required treatment, and that is if the woman is pregnant and in active labor, then she must be given assistance delivering the child. But other than that, there's no other prescription about how a doctor is supposed to act. And so just like in the context of opioids, or say there was a state marijuana prohibition like there is in Idaho, even if the doctor thinks that marijuana is the best stabilizing treatment for someone who has some chronic pain condition, they can't prescribe that in Idaho because state law controls. And so that's what the Ninth Circuit panel said, and it vacated the injunction. And we don't know what the en banc Ninth Circuit thought because they didn't tell us.
Or what the Supreme Court thought whenever they said Idaho could go ahead and enforce the law, at least by the justices consider the case.
All of us like to try to read the tea leaves. And, you know, as someone who spends a lot of time before the Supreme Court, it's dangerous to try to look into your crystal ball. I found it interesting that the court granted the injunction on appeal and granted the application as a cert petition, and there wasn't a single recorded dissent. Mm. So you can read into that whatever you want, but that was an unusually strong procedural move for the court to take without anybody writing anything about it.
Hmm. So one thing, I'll be honest here, it's sort of been difficult for me to understand exactly what the parties are arguing about, sort of the extent of the dispute. And, you know, in particular, I'm wondering, you know, Idaho law does have this exception for an abortion when it's necessary to save the life of the mother. And, you know, EMTALA, the argument is that it goes a little bit further, but how much further is it that the Biden administration is saying they need to go? I mean, it seems like there's some kind of substantial harm. I mean, how many cases are we really talking about? I mean, these are really important, obviously, in the cases where they come up, but it seems like it's
pretty rare.
Pretty rare.
Well, there's actually two answers to that question. The first answer is what the administration says the effect will be if it prevails. The other is what the actual impact will be if it prevails. So the federal government says that this is very limited. It's only when the woman's health is in danger, but not her life, that federal law would step in and state law would ordinarily prohibit it but be overridden. But it goes much broader than that because the EMTALA statute, when it refers to emergency medical condition, CMS and the federal circuits have long recognized that includes mental health conditions as well as physical emergency medical conditions. And so what that means is if a pregnant mom, say even with a viable baby, say she's past 30 weeks and the baby is fine and could be delivered and would survive fine, if she goes to the emergency room and she says, you know, I'm really anxious and depressed about having this child, I need to have an abortion or otherwise I'm going to commit suicide. And the emergency room doctor says, well, your life isn't physically in danger, but I think because of that mental health condition, the best way to stabilize it, the necessary treatment is to give you that elective abortion. Well, Idaho law would say, no, you can't do that. And prior to the Biden administration's manipulation of EMTALA, the federal government wouldn't have said that either. EMTALA defines the unborn child as a second patient. And so you need to take care of them both. And if you could deliver the baby and have them be perfectly healthy, then that's not a choice that's available even under EMTALA. And so with that mental health exception, the federal government's position basically opens up elective abortion on demand to any pro-choice doctor in any emergency room in any state to the extent that they just say, yep, I think this is the necessary treatment. But it actually goes even farther than that because it also applies to other state law prohibitions like we were talking about, whether that be opioids or marijuana or blood transfusions for minors. I mean, you name it. If there's a state law restriction, all it would take is a doctor in an emergency room to say, I think that this other thing is the only appropriate necessary stabilizing treatment. Therefore, forget about state law. I get to decide. You don't. And that flips the Medicare Act on its head because, as I mentioned, the very first provision of the Medicare Act has always directed that state law controls the practice of medicine, not the federal government.
Now, there's a kind of a sister case here kind of working its way or has worked its way through the courts as well involving EMTALA, where you're actually representing the doctors in this case out of Texas, challenging this EMTALA guidance. And so can you explain what the argument is in that case?
It's similar but slightly different. In that case, it's called Texas versus Becerra, and we are co-plaintiffs with the state of Texas. And so Texas is making a lot of the same EMTALA arguments that Idaho is making here, but they're also asserting on behalf of their doctors in Texas-funded hospitals that they have conscience rights and can't be forced to participate in abortions, notwithstanding EMTALA. And we represent pro-life doctors in that case who are making that same assertion that conscience rights protect. Now, interestingly, the federal government has insisted that pro-life doctors have to participate in abortion under EMTALA until last month in the FDA argument, in an effort to try to defeat standing of the pro-life doctor plaintiffs in the FDA abortion pill case. At oral argument, the United States said, oh, of course, conscience protections apply to individual doctors. Well, that's the opposite of everything we've been litigating in the lower courts. But ultimately, the Fifth Circuit didn't need to resolve the conscience question because it concluded, like the Ninth Circuit motions panel, that EMTALA does not dictate any particular treatment for anything that state law controls other than to deliver the baby if the mom is in active labor. And it made the additional point that if EMTALA requires that one treatment, but doesn't say anything else about any other treatments, the implication is that Congress wasn't trying to take over the other treatments, that President Reagan wasn't displacing all state pro-life laws or even other laws that control the practice of medicine.
Gotcha. So one of the things also that I'm unclear about, wow, it sounds like I'm really unclear about everything, so I'm glad that we have you here to help listeners out, but also apparently me, is sort of what EMTALA says about the life of the women or the life and health of a woman and the health of an unborn child. It seems like it sort of considers both and says, you know, doctors have to treat both and consider both. How does that actually happen? I mean, when you have sort of, the life of the mother on the line, how do doctors make those determinations?
Well, again, if the life of the mother is on the line, then even in Idaho, the doctor is allowed to terminate the pregnancy to save the life of the mom. That's a clear exception under the Idaho Defense of Life Act. And, you know, the administration and some of the hospitals are saying, well, you know, that standard is so unclear, it will chill doctors from doing the right thing in those situations. But the Idaho Supreme Court has already interpreted the act and clarified that you don't have to be absolutely certain about the decision. It just needs to be a good faith medical decision. And they also said that the emergency doesn't have to be imminent. So if you think that it's likely that an infection and death will develop quickly, you don't have to wait for that to happen. You can act now. So most of the true emergency life of the mother situations are just resolved as a matter of Idaho law. It's consistent with federal law. Where the government and Idaho part ways is in the non-life threatening situations where the mom's health is at issue, but her life isn't at issue. And that's where the administration ignores the specific EMTALA provision that treats the unborn child as a patient. And I think everybody would acknowledge that when the mother has a health risk that is not necessarily a life risk, but the baby's life is also at stake, that those are very difficult situations, and different states resolve them differently. In California or New York, they would just say, well, yeah, take the baby's life all the way to the moment before birth, and that's fine under our law. But states like Idaho, they balance those differently. That's a perfect example of how EMTALA was supposed to work. And so this is really a matter of turning EMTALA and the Medicare Act on their head to not treat the baby as a patient, to not respect state law, and to simply be an abortion mandate in the emergency room, which no one thought EMTALA was supposed to be when it was enacted back in the 1980s.
I wanted to ask you about, you know, if the court agrees with your reading of the law here, that the pregnant person deserves equal treatment to the unborn child, you know, I'm just curious about that because legal scholars that we spoke to said that the court would be for the first time giving fetuses individual rights under federal law. So this case really has kind of the potential to expand and really create a foundation for the fight for fetal rights. And I'm just curious, is that the goal of this litigation?
That is not the goal. It's what Congress required in the 1980s. You know, there's a whole fetal personhood movement, especially, you know, in the pro-life legal community, that has to do with the 14th Amendment. But this case doesn't have anything to do with that. It has to do with a definition of who the patient is in the context of EMTALA. And Congress, and this was bipartisan, Democrats and Republicans all agreed that even in the non-labor context, that the unborn child deserved the same medical treatment as mom. And so this isn't an expansion of fetal rights. This isn't some beachhead in a new push to try to get that 14th Amendment decision resolved. This is just the application of a statute that has said exactly that since the 1980s, and that's been interpreted that way ever since.
It just seems to me if the Supreme Court does recognize that and says it, that that'll be used as precedent that can be pointed to when others try to take up that fetal personhood fight and go even further and, you know, assign rights to embryos or fetuses. Like, it seems like this could be very foundational in that way.
I think it would be difficult outside the EMTALA context. You know, keeping in mind that EMTALA is a very narrow statute that says if someone's in critical medical condition and they show up at the emergency room, you must give them treatment. So it's hard to imagine that this is going to blossom into some kind of fetal personhood movement. I would personally welcome that. I think that we should recognize that the unborn are entitled to the same respect, dignity, and protection as all the rest of us. But this isn't a case that's going to do anything other than apply a congressional statute that there really wasn't any disagreement with for many, many years.
That'll do it for us. Thank you so much for joining us, John. We really appreciate having you on.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Okay, so I'm not sure, though, even after that interview, that I'm totally clear about what Idaho and the federal government are arguing over. I mean, it seems like a really small, like I said, a very important sliver of cases, but very small. And I'm not quite sure I understand totally what the stakes are here.
Right. And I'm not sure if, you know, how broadly the court is going to go here. It seems like they were interested during that fight over that abortion pill mifepristone earlier this term. You know, there was that reference to the conscience objections, and the Solicitor General was specifically asked, you know, like, are there protections for conscience objections in EMTALA? And the Solicitor General said yes. So I wonder if that kind of closes out this fight or not.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Actually, that reminds me, I'm not the only one who's confused about what they're fighting over. Some of the justices were too. All right, I feel better. Thanks,
no,
Lydia.
You're welcome.
That's
Kimberly.
Your job.
Some weeks I feel confused all the time. It's part of covering the court, I think. But I think that's going to do it for this week. The court will hear arguments next week in Donald Trump's appeal for immunity from being criminally prosecuted for trying to overturn the 2020 election with his actions on January 6th. We'll unpack those arguments next Friday. Until then, you can follow along with all the latest Supreme Court news at news.bloomberglaw.com.
If you're a litigator, finding relevant docket filings is crucial. Pinpoint winning arguments faster with Bloomberg Law. Our market-leading docket coverage has been enhanced with AI-driven search and analytics, lightning-fast customized notifications, and expanded state court coverage. And we've substantially increased our litigation news coverage, so you'll always be in the know. Smart litigators rely on Bloomberg Law. Visit pro.bloomberglaw.com today and get everything you need to secure big wins.